Chapter 9. Although the Surprise had stood in as far as ever she could, far in among the countless islands, the pilot galley still had a long pull before it set Stephen down on the broad quay in the heart of the town. Once the sun had risen, the day was fresh and brilliant. The breeze, though contrary, was full of life, and by the time Stephen reached dry land he had almost entirely detached himself from that other world, the world of his dream, with its extraordinary beauty and its potential danger, its half-understood threat of extreme danger to come. The pilot, a grave, respectable man fluent in English, took him to a grave, respectable hotel, equally fluent. Here Stephen called for coffee and buns, and much refreshed he went to see his banker's correspondent, who, having received him with the deference that he was now beginning to think his due, or at least that he no longer found particularly amusing, provided him with Swedish money and the address of the best apothecary in the capital. "A learned man, a man of encyclopedic knowledge, a pupil of the great Linnaeus himself," whose shop was not 100 yards away. Dr. Maturin had but to turn twice to the right, and he was there. Dr. Maturin turned twice to the right, and there indeed he was. The window was quite unmistakable, being filled not only with the usual great jars of green, red, and blue liquid, clear and jewel-like, and with bunches of dried herbs, but also with a large variety of monsters and uncommon animals in spirits, together with skeletons, one being that of an aardvark. Stephen walked in. There appeared to be nobody in the shop, and he was looking attentively at the fetus of a kangaroo. He had, in fact, reached out his hand to turn the jar, when a very small man stepped from behind the counter and asked him his business, in a sharp, troll-like voice. Stephen felt certain that the encyclopedia's knowledge embraced neither English nor French, so he said, "I should like some laudanum, if you please, a bottle of moderate, portable size, in Latin." To which the apothecary replied, "Certainly," in a more benevolent tone. While the tincture was prepared, Stephen said, "Pray, is the aardvark in the window for sale?"
"No, sir," said the apothecary. "He belongs to my own collection." And after a pause, "You recognize the animal, I perceive?" "At one time I was well acquainted with an aardvark," said Stephen. "A most affectionate creature, though timid. That was at the Cape, and I saw a skeleton belonging to Monsieur Cuvier in Paris."
"Ah, sir! You are a great traveller, I find," said the apothecary, clasping the bottle with both hands and raising it to head height.
"I am a naval surgeon, and my profession has carried me to many parts of the world."
"It was always my dream to travel," said the apothecary, "but I am tied to my shop. However, I encourage the sailors to bring me what falls in their way, and I commission the more intelligent surgeon's mates to find me botanical specimens and foreign drugs, curious teas, infusions, and the like. So I travel vicariously."
"It may well be that you travel better than I. Until you have experienced it, you cannot conceive the frustrations that attend the naturalist in a ship. He has no sooner started to get some order among, let us say, the termites, than he is told that the wind has changed, or that the tide serves, and he must repair aboard, or he will infallibly be left behind. I was in New Holland once, and I saw these creatures," pointing to the kangaroo, "sporting on a grassy plain, but was I indulged in a horse to approach them, or even the loan of a perspective glass? No, sir, I was not. I was told that if I was not on the strand in 10 minutes, a file of marines should be sent to fetch me. Whereas you, sir, have 100 eyes, and only the single inconvenience of remaining physically in the same place while your mind roams abroad. You have some remarkable collections," looking at the walls.
"Here is the true balm of Gilead," said the apothecary, "and here salamander's wool. Here the black mandrake of Kamchatka."
He showed many more rarities, chiefly of a medical nature, and after a while Stephen asked, "Have any of your young men ever brought you back the coca or cuca leaf from Peru?"
"Oh, yes," said the apothecary. "There is a small sack behind the chamomile. It is said to dissolve the gross humours and do away with appetite."
"Be so good as to put me up a pound," said Stephen. "And lastly, can you tell me where the district of Christenberg lies? I should like to walk there, if it is not too far."
"It will not take you above an hour. I will draw you a map. This is a meadow filled with iris pseudocorus, and on the shore just beyond it, near the bridge,
you may see a nest of the tuberculated swan. The name of the house that I wish to find is Königsby. It is here where I put the cross.
Stephen's intention was to determine the place where Diana lived, and to get some feeling of the country around her. He then meant to come back to his hotel, summon a barber, change his shirt — he had put up three, a spare neckcloth and a waistcoat — dine, and send a message asking if he might call. He had no notion of making his appearance at her door without a word of warning. He crossed the necessary bridges and passed the Serafima Hospital, looking attentively at it as he went by. The houses soon thinned out, and presently he was walking along a wide road between fields, in gently rolling country, mostly pasture, with woods on either hand, a pleasant impression of prevailing green. Moderate farms, some cottages, and here and there a large house among its trees. He noticed with satisfaction that the crows were all of the grey-backed Irish kind. There was not much traffic on the road, broad and well-kept though it was. Two coaches, the occasional gig and farm cart, and perhaps half a dozen horsemen. A few people on foot — they all called out a greeting as they passed, and Stephen, influenced by the greenness and the crows, replied in Irish, "God and Mary and Patrick be with you." Not much traffic on the high road, and even less when Stephen, having looked at the apothecary's map again, turned off right-handed on what was no more than a narrow country lane leading through meadows, all fenced with shabby post and rails, as though they belonged to one large but somewhat neglected estate, an impression strengthened by occasional glimpses of a long park wall to the south. He had found the marshy fields of irises, and he had seen the swan upon her nest, when he heard the sound of horses' hooves ahead. An alder grove hid them, but they were certainly near, and they were certainly drawing a vehicle at a fine clipping pace. He looked about for somewhere to get off the lane, even more constricted here because of the ditches on either hand, broad ditches with a bank on the far side and the fence on top of it. He chose the least broad part of the right-hand ditch, took the string of his parcel in his teeth, sprang across, caught the rail, and stood there poised on the bank. As the carriage came into sight, he saw that it was a phaeton with a pair of chestnuts, and a moment later his heart stood still. Diana was driving.
"Oh, Maturin, God love you," she cried, reining in hard. "Oh, how happy I am to see you, my dear."
The groom ran to take the horses' heads, and she sprang down onto the green verge.
"Give a good leap," she called, holding out her hand, "and you will clear the ditch for sure."
She caught him as he landed, took his parcel, and kissed him on both cheeks.
"How happy I am to see you," she said again. "Get in, and I will drive you home." "You have not changed at all," she went on, setting the horses in motion. "You have, my dear," he said in a fairly level voice. "Your complexion is infinitely improved. You are a jeune fille en fleur."
It was true. The cooler, damper northern climate and the Swedish diet had done wonders for her skin. Her particular black-haired, dark-blue-eyed kind of beauty required an excellence of complexion to set it off at its best, and she was now in a finer bloom than he had ever seen her. They reached a gate into a field, and here she turned the phaeton with her usual skill, driving back along the lane at an exhilarating speed, the more so since in some place the wheels were not 6 inches from the edge, and since the near horse showed a tendency to toss his head and play the fool, calling for a very firm hand and great watchfulness, too much for sustained conversation. They repassed the alder grove, struck into a broader road.
"That is the way to Stadhagen," she said,
and reached a pair of open iron gates where the horses turned in of their own accord. The weed-grown drive made a couple of winds among the trees and then forked, one branch leading across the park to a large house, rather fine but blind and lifeless, being almost entirely shut up.
"That is Countess Tessin's place," said Diana. "Jagiello's grandmamma. I live over there."
She pointed with her whip, and at the far end of the park Stephen saw a smaller, much older building with a tower. He took it to be a dower house, but made no observation. The phaeton drew up. The groom leapt down and led it away.
"Would that man be a Finn at all?" asked Stephen. "Oh, no," said Diana, amused. "He is a Lapp, one of Jagiello's Lapps. He owns a dozen or so." "Slaves, are they?" "No, not really, I think. More in the way of serfs.
Stephen, do come in."
The door had opened, and a tall, bent, elderly maidservant stood there, curtsying and smiling. Diana shouted something in Swedish very close to her ear and led Stephen into the hall. She opened one door, shut it again with the words, "Too squalid," and opened another, which led into a pleasant little square room with a piano, bookshelves, a great china stove, two or three elbow chairs, and a sofa. The window looked out onto a lime tree. Diana took one of the chairs, said, "Sit where I can see you, Stephen. Sit on the sofa." She gazed at him affectionately and said, "Lord, it is so long since I saw you, and there are so many things to talk about I do not know where to begin." A pause. "Oh, I will just say something about Jagiello. It is not that I owe you any explanation, Maturin, you know," quite kindly, "but he will be here presently, and I do not wish you to think yourself obliged to cut his throat. Poor lamb, that would be too hard. When I told him that I should be happy to put myself under his protection to go to Sweden, I meant just that, protection against insult or persecution or ill-treatment, and no more, as I said quite clearly. And I said I should, of course, pay my own way. Protection, in the plain sense, was what I wanted, not a bedfellow. He did not believe it. Indeed, even while he was protesting all possible respect, brotherly sentiments, and so on, he smirked, as men will smirk, I'm afraid. For a great while he would not be persuaded that I meant what I said, but in the end he was obliged to. I told him it was no use. I had sworn I should never put it in any man's power to hurt me again. Do not look so catastrophe, Stephen. It is all over now. I am heart whole, and I hope to God we are not such simpletons as to let it prevent us from being very, very fond of one another. But as I was saying, he had to believe it, and now we are friends again, though he does keep trying to prevent me from going up in balloons. He is to be married to a sweetly pretty young woman that dotes upon him. Not very clever, but good family, and a splendid portion. I helped to arrange it, and his grandmother is so pleased with me. That is to say, when she remembers, which is not always the case.
"I am glad to hear what you tell me, Villiers, dear," began Stephen.
But he was interrupted by the coming of the maidservant, to whom Diana roared as loud as she was able, and then, rather hoarse, said,
"Ulrika tells me there are only eggs in the house and smoked trout. I was going shopping when we met, and she asks whether the gentleman would like some of the Lapp's dried reindeer."
Ulrika watched Stephen's face, and seeing its look of pleased acquiescence, walked off chuckling.
"Well, that deals with Gediman Jagiello," said Diana. "Though, by the way, when they come, we shall have to speak French. Her English is even worse. Now let us begin at the beginning. Where have you come from?"
"From England, in the Surprise, with Jack Aubrey."
"Is he in Stockholm?"
"He has run across to Riga, but he will be back in a day or two. He sends his love, their love. He particularly said, 'Give Cousin Diana our love.'"
"Dear Jack! Lord, we were in such a rage about that monstrous trial, Jagiello and I. He is constantly at the legation and has all the English papers. Did Jack take it very hard?"
"Terribly hard, indeed. During the voyage before last, running down to the Azores, you would hardly have known he was the same man. Cold, unsmiling, no human contact with the new officers or men, little even with the old. He put the fear of God into them. I have noticed that in a ship you cannot act a part successfully for long. The people very soon detect any falsity, but they recognise true feelings, and in this case they were quite terrified of him."
"Yet it was in the Azores that he made all those prizes. Surely that put him in a better humour?"
"Oh, he was relieved for Sophie and the children. Things were in a sad way at Ashgrove, I believe, but the prize money, even though it came in such floods, did not touch the heart of the matter. It was the St. Martin's affair which did that."
"Oh, yes, yes, how we cheered! There was Captain Fanshawe at the legation, who said it was the completest thing of its kind ever seen this war. Surely he will be reinstated now."
"I believe he may. The more so as his cousin Norton has given him the seat of Millport, a pocket borough in the west."
"That makes it a certainty with divisions so close. I am so glad for them both. I am very fond of Sophie. Stephen, forgive me for a moment. I must see about that reindeer. The Lapp may be difficult with Ulrika. He does not belong to this house, you know. Jagiello just lends him to me, together with the phaeton and the horses, to take his grandmother to church and sometimes to town. But he is quite all right with me."
Left alone, Stephen reflected. At one time it had occurred to him that Diana might possibly make her balloon ascents by way of amusement. Now it seemed far more probable that his first idea, and Blaine's, was right. Her present life might not be grinding poverty, but it was certainly very far from wealth. His mind ran on, trying to compose his extreme hurry and agitation of spirit so that he might work out a persuasive, coherent way of expressing himself. He took the apothecary's bottle from his pocket, and he was breaking the sealing wax on the wrapping when she came back, carrying his parcel.
"Stephen," she said, "you left this in the carriage. Bishan brought it to the kitchen."
"Oh, thank you," he cried, thrusting the bottle back. "It is the coca leaves I bought in Stockholm."
"What are they for?"
"They relieve fatigue, and properly administered they make you feel clever and even witty. I sent you some from South America."
"Alas, they never came. I should have liked to feel clever, or even witty."
"I am so sorry. Things miscarry. Tell me, did you ever receive a letter I sent from Gibraltar just before sailing on the South American voyage? I gave it to Andrew Ray, who was travelling home overland."
"Surely to God, Maturin, you did not trust that infernal scrub Ray, did you? I saw him once or twice after he came back, said he had seen you in Malta and that you had listened to music together. You seemed to be amusing yourself prodigiously with a diving bell and the other delights of Valletta. He never spoke of any letter or message. I hope it was nothing confidential."
"There was nothing in it that a stranger would have understood," said Stephen, standing up. For at this point an old lady opened the door. She was Countess Tessin. Diana made the introductions, speaking French, and adding that Stephen was a friend of Gediman's. She presented him as Monsieur Maturin Idomanova, which was perfectly correct, though disingenuous. She need not have troubled. The old lady was somewhat confused, and on learning that Jagiello was not expected until after dinner, she set off again, though pressed to stay.
"May I give you my arm, ma'am?" asked Stephen. "You are very kind, sir, most amiable. But I have Axel waiting for me, and he is so used to my pace."
"If ever I become old," said Diana at dinner, "I do hope I shall manage to keep up with the changing ideas of money."
"Not many people do so."
"No, Countess Tessin has not. And the change has frightened her into, well, I do not like to say avarice, because she is really very kind, but she says she has to watch every penny, and she has turned almost all her servants away. She charges me a shocking great rent, and she has let out practically the whole park for grazing, so that I have only one poor little paddock. I had so hoped to breed Arabians, but there is no room." "Stephen, you are not eating." "I have a couple, one an enchanting little mare, that I must show you after dinner, but if only I had anything like that fine sweep of short grass at Jack Aubrey's place up on the down, I should have a score."
"I am afraid my agitation is affecting her," thought Stephen. "This is not her manner at all."
He applied himself to eating with all the appearance of appetite he could manage, and listened to her remarks about English lessons. Little scope for her endeavours, since so many Swedes spoke English anyhow, and about this absurd showman who gave her quite large sums for going up in balloons.
"He wants me to wear spangles next time," she said.
Stephen had rarely been less master of his emotions, less capable of small talk. He felt this increasing upon him, and he positively blessed the false movement on Diana's part that sent the decanter crashing to the ground.
"That was the last of the wine," she said with a smile. "But at least I can make you a decent cup of coffee. That is one thing I can do in the domestic line."
The coffee was indeed excellent. They drank it sitting on a terrace to the south of the house, and the Arabian mare came to see them, walking with polite, diffident steps until she was sure of her welcome. She stood with her head over Diana's shoulder, looking into her face with great, lustrous eyes, and Diana said,
"She follows me about like a dog. When she can get indoors, upstairs and down, she's the only horse I have ever known I should dare to get into the car of a balloon with. I doubt I have ever seen such a beautiful and sympathetic creature before," said Stephen.
The mare's beauty heightened Diana's, and the pair they made filled him with a troubled joy. When they had seen the stables, the other Arabian,
"Only a gelding," Diana observed,
and when they had thoroughly condemned the paddock, they walked back to the house. The tension had fallen, and they talked easily. Diana's cousins, Sophie's children, the rebuilding of the grapes, Mrs. Broad's prosperity. In the hall, Stephen said,
"My dear, may I retire? And may I also have a glass? I must take a dose."
Sitting there, he measured out the laudanum, his practiced thumb over the bottle's mouth, a dose suited to the occasion. The first sip startled him extremely.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," he said, "the troll must use aquavit."
He soon grew used to the different taste, however, a difference that he attributed entirely to the different spirit used in the tincture. When he had finished his glass, he took off his breeches, and not without pain, he disengaged the blue diamond, strapped to his person with court plaster. He wiped the warm stone, looked at it with renewed admiration, and put it into his waistcoat pocket. Even as he went down the stairs, he felt that his dose was already working, and he walked into the little square room in a reasonably collected state of mind, determined to stake his happiness on the one throw. Diana looked round with a smile.
"I must get this piano tuned," she said, playing a little ripple of notes with her right hand as she stood there. "Do you remember that piece of Hummel's that Sophie used to work at so hard, long, long ago? It came into my head, but there is a false note here," playing it, "that throws everything out." "A Judas of a note," said Stephen.
His hands wandered over the keys, taking pieces from the Hummel, working out variations on them, improvising, and then he played the air of Almaviva's Contessa Perdona. He could not trust himself to sing with it. His voice would be ludicrous or false, or both. But closing the piano, he said,
"Diana, I have come to be forgiven."
"But, my dear, you are forgiven. You have been this great while. I am very fond of you. There is not a scrap of rancor or resentment or ill will in my heart, I swear."
"That is not quite what I meant, honey."
"Oh, as for the rest, Stephen, our marriage was absurd in the first place. I should never make any kind of a wife for you. I love you dearly, but we could only wound one another, completely unsuited, each as independent as a cat."
"I should ask nothing but your company. I have made a great deal of prize money. I have inherited more. I say this only because it means you could have room for your Arabians. You could have half the Curragh of Kildare. You could have a great stretch of English downland."
"Stephen, you know what I said to Jagiello. I will not put myself in any man's power. But if ever I were to live with a man as his wife, it would be with you. There is no one else at all. I beg you to take that for my answer."
"I will not be importunate, my dear," said Stephen.
He stood at the window, looking out onto the lime tree's perfect green. After some moments he turned with a somewhat artificial smile and said,
"Will I tell you an extraordinarily vivid dream I had this morning, Villiers? It had to do with a balloon."
"A fire balloon or an air balloon?"
"I think it must have been an air balloon. I should have remembered the fire. In any event, there I was in its car, and I was above the clouds, a vast stratum of white clouds, rolling and immensely domed in themselves, but all in a united plane below me. And above, there was the unbelievably pure and very dark blue sky."
"Oh, yes, yes," cried Diana.
"All this I had from a man who had been up. For myself, I have never left the ground at all. But what I had not derived from his account was the extraordinary intensification of living, the palpable depth of the universal silence, and the very great awareness of the light and colour of this other world, an otherness that was made all the stronger because through an occasional gap in the clouds our ordinary world could be seen, with silver rivers very, very far below, and the roads distinct. Yet in time that changed to rock and ice, even farther below. And in my keen delight there was mingled an undefined sense of a dread as huge as the sky itself. It was not merely a fear of being destroyed, but worse, perhaps that of being wholly and entirely lost, body and soul."
"How did it end?"
"It did not end at all. There was Jack roaring out that the boat was alongside. Jagiello used to tell me dismal stories of people being carried higher and higher and farther, swept quite away, perished with cold, starved, never seen again. But I only go up in an air balloon, one with a valve, so that you can let the stuff out and come down. And we have an anchor on a long rope. I always have Gustav with me. He is thoroughly experienced and very strong, and we never go far." "Dear Villiers, I'm not trying to frighten you or put you off, God forbid. This was my dream, not a lecture or a parable. I found it deeply impressive, particularly the enhanced sense of colour. The balloon itself was a noble red, and I told it to you partly for that reason, though the dear knows my account was most pitifully bald, never touching the essence at all, and partly to set a space between what we were talking about before and what I am going to say next. A space by way of symbolizing the total independence of the two conversations. Do you remember Danglars in Paris, La Motte's friend?
Yes, she said, her somewhat remote, defiant expression changing to one of inquiry.
He promised that you should have your great diamond back, the Blue Peter, that eventually he would send it after us. He kept his word, and a messenger brought it just after Jack's trial. Here it is.
He had never seen her lose her composure to such a degree. As he passed the stone, naked in the blaze of the sun, her face showed doubt, amazement, delight, and even a kind of fear, before dissolving entirely as she burst into tears. Stephen returned to the window and stood there until he heard her blow her nose and sniff. She sat there with a diamond cupped in her hands. He observed that her pupils were dilated, so much so that her blue eyes looked black.
"I never thought I should see it again," she said in a tremulous voice. "And I loved it so. Oh, I loved it sinfully. I still love it sinfully," she said, turning it this way and that in the shaft of sunlight. "I cannot tell you how grateful I am. And I was so odiously unkind to you, Stephen. Forgive me."
A voice outside called, "Diana!" She said,
"Oh God, there are the Jagiellos,"
and looked quickly round. But there was no escape, and a moment later the door was pushed open. It was the little Arabian mare that walked in, however, followed some moments later by the Jagiellos. Although Stephen was standing with his back to the strong light, Jagiello recognized him at once. For a moment his first look of astonished delight changed to one of extreme reserve, but then his potential adversary came forward, took him affectionately by the hand, thanked him for his kindness to Diana, and congratulated him on his coming marriage and his promotion. For Jagiello's beautiful mauve coat now had a colonel's marks of rank, and he wore golden spurs. Diana had a great sense of social duty, and having led the horse away and done what she could to a face much altered by tears, blubbered was hardly too strong a word, for she was not a woman who cried easily or without trace. She did her best to entertain her guests. But Lovisa, Jagiello's fiancée, was exceedingly young. She had always been in awe of Diana, held up by Jagiello as a paragon, and now her youth, her respect, and her sterling native stupidity, combined with her ignorance of French and her suspicion that the atmosphere was uneasy, to make her a very heavy burden. Jagiello was a little better, but he did see that his usual gay prattle would be out of place in the present context, and being so taken aback by the whole situation, he could not readily hit upon an alternative. Stephen, whose social sense could never have recommended him anywhere, said a few civil things to Lovisa, who was indeed absurdly pretty, and then, perceiving that Diana was telling Jagiello the latest news of Jack Aubrey, he too lapsed into silence. He had been feeling very strange for some time, and this he attributed to intensity of emotion. Just what the nature of the emotion was, apart from the obvious desolation of failure, he could not yet tell. There was the analogy of wounds in battle. You knew you had been hit, and roughly where, but whether by blade, point, ball, or splinter, you could not tell, nor how gravely, until you had time to examine the wounds and name them. Yet he did long for these people to go away, so that he might take a second dose, a dose that would quieten his heart and enable him to walk back to Stockholm with at least the appearance of equanimity. At last, Diana was inspired to tell Jagiello that his grandmother had called before dinner, and to suggest that he should hurry to the big house to prevent her setting out again. Countess Tessin would surely have seen them go by, and the double walk would be too much for her. Jagiello thankfully agreed. He had felt in the way from the first few minutes, without being able to contrive any plausible reason for taking his leave. But after the first farewells, and at the open hall door itself, Lovisa began to tell Diana about her wedding clothes. She went on and on and on, in Swedish most of the time, and Stephen backed and backed until with a final bow he could disappear upstairs. Once again he was astonished at the strength of his draught, and this time it occurred to him that the difference might lie in the opium rather than the menstruum.
"And yet," he reflected as he walked downstairs. "I have never heard of any marked variation between the pharmacopoeias of different countries in that respect. Within the range of a few scruples to the ounce, the tincture is the same at a respectable apothecary's in Paris or Dublin, Boston or Barcelona."
"Lord Maturin," said Diana, "I thought they would never go. That silly, pretty goose was still talking about the embroidery on her gown when Countess Tessin came in sight, but then I did give Jagiello a shove at last, and he took her away."
"There is much to be said for Jagiello."
"Yes, and this time he did not utter a single word against balloons, though he knows very well I mean to go up on Saturday."
"This coming Saturday?"
"Yes, they have begun filling it already."
"May I come too?"
"Of course you may. It is the red balloon this time, so there will be plenty of room in the car. Would you like to see it?"
Stephen did not answer until she said, "Would you like to see it?" again. Then he looked up, a little dazed, and replied,
"That would be delightful. Do you keep it here?"
"Oh, no, no, it is a vast great thing, but they are filling it at the foundry. They use iron filings and vitriol to make the inflammable air, you know, and you can see it from the tower. Stephen, are you feeling quite well?"
"A trifle odd, my dear, I must confess. But then I was roused before dawn. I am perfectly capable of running up the tower."
"We will take it gently. There is a spyglass on top of the cupboard behind you."
She led the way to a vaulted corridor at the back of the hall and so to the dark tower beyond, far older than the present house.
"Take great care, Stephen," she called back as she climbed the spiral staircase. "Keep to the wall side. There is no rail in the middle after halfway."
Winding and winding in the dim shadows, they came to a dwarfish door at the top and crept out into the brilliant light. They were surprisingly high, and the whole island lay spread out below them.
"This way," said Diana, leading him to the eastern parapet.
There was the old city of Stockholm, about an hour's walk away, and rather to one side of it, the tall chimneys of industry. Diana had been carrying the Blue Peter. She now wrapped it in a handkerchief, put it in her pocket, and levelled the telescope at the chimneys.
"There," she said, "get the one that is smoking so, move to the left, and there in the yard you see the upper half of a great round red thing. That is my balloon."
"God bless it," said Stephen, handing back the glass.
"I think we should go down and have a cup of tea," said Diana, studying his face. "You look like whitey brown paper. You go first and I will follow. I know just where to find the bolts."
Stephen opened the door, said something indistinct about Saturday, and pitched headlong into the void. It seemed that in spite of obscure delays and disturbances, the ascent had been postponed rather than cancelled. At least if it had been a public performance at all, it must have been on a very modest scale, since he could remember no crowd, no noise. He did have confused memories of a tumble, of indeterminate injuries and fuss which muffled the immediate past, and now they had risen above the clouds, a fairly apt parallel for his passing fogginess of mind, and now they were in the pure upper air, with that strangely familiar dark blue above and on either hand, unless he looked over the edge of the car and down to the fantastic convolutions and the slowly changing geography of the cloud world below. All much purer and more intense even than his dream, which he remembered perfectly. And although his dream had heightened colour, it had not done so to this miraculous degree. The wickerwork of the car had an infinity of very beautiful shades, from dark brown to something lighter than straw, while the ropes that led from the network enveloping the balloon itself had a subtlety all their own. It was as though he had never seen rope before, or as though he had recovered his sight after many years of blindness, and when he looked across at Diana, the perfection of her cheek fairly caught his breath. She was sitting there in a green riding habit with her hands folded in her lap. She was looking down at her diamond, and her eyes were almost closed, the long lashes hiding them. They were both of them silent. This was a world of silence. Yet he was conscious that they were perfectly in tune and that no amount of talking would make them more so. He reflected upon height, the effect of height. How much was it height alone that gave this much keener sense of life? He retraced his very long climb up the flank of the Maladetta to the highest point he'd ever reached on land. A mule in the morning darkness from Benasque, up and up through the forenoon to the highest cow pasture, with streams as thick as a barrel gushing straight from the bare rock face by the path, a pause at the hut and then on by foot, up through vast sweeps of low rhododendron until they gave way to gentians, countless gentians in the short turf, up to the rocky edge of the glacier, where a host of tall primulas stood in their perfection, exactly disposed as though all the king's gardeners had been at work. All these things, together with the troop of fleeing chamois below him, and the pair of eagles turning and turning above, had been very clearly perceived in that thin, keen air. But not with anything like an equal clarity. And here there was also a difference in kind. During that long day he had been strongly aware of time, if only because he had to avoid being benighted on the mountainside. Now there was no time. That is to say, there was succession in that a gesture or a thought followed its predecessor, but there was no sense of duration. He and Diana might have been floating there for hours, or even for days. And then again, although the Maladetta was physically dangerous, it had nothing of the indefinable threat present in this immensity. Diana had almost certainly dozed off, and he said nothing, nor did he speak of the high mist that veiled the sky, giving the sun a double halo and producing two fine prismatic sun-dogs. He was, in fact, surprisingly sleepy himself, and presently he, too, closed his eyes. At the very beginning of his dream he could say, "I am dreaming." But his perception of it faded almost at once, and he was filled with as much anxiety as he would have been if he had never had a hint of this being only the disturbance of a sleeping mind. It was clear to him now that they had set off, the wind being favourable, for Spitsbergen, where they would surely fall in with the whalers who congregated there at this time of the year, and where they would view the wonders of the Arctic so well described by Mulgrave, and the northern wall of ice that had barred his way to the pole. But there had been some disagreement, and although at one time a rocky landscape had been seen below, they had not made any attempt to descend, and now there was nothing in sight but grey ocean stretching from sky to sky. Dream within dream. And this dissolved to an unknown room. Diana was there, no longer wearing her riding habit but a plain grey dress. And Jagiello, together with two men in black coats and bob wigs who were obviously physicians, the one a fool and the other exceptionally intelligent. They spoke to Diana in Swedish, which Jagiello usually translated, her acquaintance with the language being barely enough for ordinary housekeeping, and they discussed the case between themselves in Latin. Soon they were joined by a third whom they treated with marked deference. He wore the star of an order, and who recommended cupping. The leg, he said, presented no particular problem. He had seen many fractures of this kind, and they had always yielded to Anderson's Basra method, so long as the patient was in a reasonable state of health. Here, to be sure, there was a vicious habit of body, some degree of undernourishment, and what he would scarcely hesitate to call incipient melancholia. Yet they were to observe that the frame, though spare, was well knit, and there were still some lingering traces of youth to be made out. Stephen watched them for a while as they went through the grave gestures of consultation, part of the gravity being directed at the audience, part at one another, but he was too familiar with this kind of meeting for it to have much interest, and presently his attention shifted to his surroundings, and to Diana and Jagiello. The intuition peculiar to dreams told him that this was Diana's room, that this was her bed itself, and that she spent her time on the chaise longue beside it, looking after him with the utmost tenderness. He also knew that Jagiello had called in the king's physician, the person with the star who was now saying that when he came to the point of eating solids, the patient should be allowed no beef or mutton, still less any swine's flesh, but rather a hazel hen, seethed with a very little barley. "Hazel hen," he thought. "Never have I seen a hazel hen. Yet if this good man's advice is followed, I shall soon incorporate one. I shall be, in part, a hazel hen, with whatever virtues a hazel hen may possess." He reflected upon Finn McCool and his salmon, and while he was reflecting there in the twilight, lamps were lit. He was reflecting still when they were put out, all but a single one turned low, and now the chief light in the room came from a fire away on his right hand, a live, flickering glow on the ceiling. There had no doubt been discreet farewells, and someone had surely prescribed. But now Diana was alone, sitting on the chaise longue beside the bed. She laid her hand on the back of his and said very quietly, "Oh, Stephen,
Stephen. How I wish you could hear me, my dear."
But now there was this evil balloon again, and now he was living with time in the sense of duration once more, for he knew with dreadful certainty that they had been rising for hours on end, that they were now rising faster still, and as they soared towards this absolute purity of sky, so its imminent threat, half perceived at first, filled him with a horror beyond anything he had known. Diana was wearing her green coat again, and at some point she must have turned up the collar, for now its red underneath made a shocking contrast with the extreme pallor of her face, the pinched white of her nose and the frosted blue of her lips. Her face showed no expression. She was, as it were, completely alone. And as she had done before, she held her head down, bowed over her lap, where her hands, now more loosely clasped, held the diamond, very like a sliver of this brilliant sky itself. She was breathing still, but only just, as they floated away, always higher and into even more rarefied air. Breathing, but only just, a very slight movement indeed. Then even that stopped. Her senses were going, going. Her head drooped forward, the diamond fell, and he started up, crying, "No, no, no!" in the extremity of passionate refusal. "Quiet, Stephen," she said, taking him in her arms and easing him back in bed. "Easy there," as though she were talking to a horse. And then, as though she were talking to a man, "You must take care of your poor leg, my dear." He leant on her warmth, slipping back through several realities to this, though without much certainty of its existence. Yet his certainty grew stronger as he lay there through the night, watching the glow of the fire and hearing a clock strike the hours. And sometimes she moved about, putting on more wood or attending to his squalid needs, and doing so with an efficiency and a tenderness that moved him very deeply. And in these short exchanges his words were relevant and intelligible. They had known one another these many years, but their relations had never called for tenderness on her side, and he would have said that it formed no part of her character. Courage, spirit, and determination, yes, but nothing nearer tenderness than generosity and good nature. He was weak, having been much battered in his physical and metaphysical fall, and having eaten nothing since, weak and somewhat maudlin. And reflecting upon this new dimension, he wept silently in the darkness. In the morning he heard her stir and said, "Diana, Joy, are you awake?" She came over, looked into his face, kissed him, and said, "You are in your right wits still, sweetheart, thanks be. I was so afraid you would slip back into your nightmares about the balloon. Did I talk a great deal?" "Yes, you did, my poor lamb. There was no comforting you. It was oh so distressing, and oh so long." "Hours, was it?" "Days, Stephen." He considered this, and the violent stabs of pain in his leg. "Listen," he said, "would there be any coffee in the house? And a piece of biscuit, maybe? I raven. And tell, did the bottle in my pocket survive?" "No, it broke. It nearly killed you, a most frightful gash in your side." When she had gone, he looked at his leg, deep in plaster according to the Basra method, and under the bandage round his belly. The broken glass must have gone very near the peritoneum. "Were I in a still weaker state, I should look upon that as an omen, an awful warning," he said. They had finished their breakfast, and they were talking companionably, when Dr. Messenius, the most intelligent of the medical men, came to ask how the patient did, and to dress his wound. Stephen mentioned the pain in his leg.
"I trust you will not ask me to prescribe laudanum, colleague," said Messenius, looking him in the eye. "I have known cases where a few minims, taken after a very massive dose, accidental or otherwise, have caused extreme and lasting mental distress, allied to that which you have just suffered, but more durable, leading on occasion to lunacy and death."
"Have you any reason to suppose that I had taken laudanum?"
"Your pupils, of course. And the apothecary's label was still on the broken glass. A wise physician would no more add a drop of laudanum to an already overcharged body than a gunner would take a naked light into a powder magazine.
Many medical men use the tincture against pain and emotional disturbance.
Certainly. But in this case I am persuaded that we should be well advised to bear the pain and deal with the agitation by exhibiting a moderate dose of hellebore.
Stephen felt inclined to congratulate Messenius on his fortitude, but he did not, and they parted on civil terms. Within the limits of his information, Messenius was right. He obviously thought that his patient was addicted to laudanum, and he had no means of knowing, as Stephen knew, that this frequent and indeed habitual use was not true addiction, but just the right side of it. The boundary was difficult to define, and he did not blame Messenius for his mistake, the less so as his body was at this moment feeling more than a hint of that craving which was the mark of a man who had gone too far. Yet the present unsteady emotional state must be taken in hand. The pain he could bear, but he would never forgive himself if he were to weep at Diana or behave weakly. Diana came back.
"He is so pleased with you and with your wound," she said, "but he says I am not to give you any laudanum."
"I know. He thinks it might do harm in this case. He may be right."
"And Jagiello asks whether you would like his man to come and shave you, and then whether you would feel strong enough to see him."
"Should be very happy. How kind in Jagiello.
Diana, my dear, please may I have that little parcel I brought with me? The leaves that make you feel clever and witty?
Stephen,
are you quite sure they will not do you any harm?"
"Never in life, my dearest soul. The Peruvians and their neighbours chew coca day and night. It is as usual as tobacco."
By the time Jagiello's valet had shaved him, Stephen's mouth was already tingling pleasantly from his quid of coca. By the time Jagiello had paid him a short but most cordial visit, the leaves had entirely taken away his sense of taste, a small price to pay for the calming and strengthening of his mind. The loss of taste could hardly have come at a better moment, for after Stephen had been contemplating the coca's undoubted action on his leg for some time, Diana brought a bottle of physic sent by Messenius, a spectacularly disagreeable emulsion. Nor could the consolidation of his mind, now firmly seated on its base, because 3 days later, 3 days of an unabated tenderness that had bound him to her more than ever before, Diana came in at the stroke of 10 with bottle and spoon, and having dosed him she fidgeted strangely about the room before settling at last on the chaise longue.
"Maturin," she said in an embarrassed voice, "what happened to my wits the day we met, I cannot tell. I have never been clever at remembering years or history or the order things happened in, but really this goes beyond all. It was only as I was running downstairs just now that a flash of common sense burst upon me and said, 'Why, Diana, you damned fool, it might have been his answer.'"
Stephen did not like to seem to understand at once. He shifted the ball of coca leaves into his cheek, considered for a moment, and said,
"The letter I gave Ray was an answer to one of yours in which you were not quite pleased, in which you desired me to explain rumours that I was flaunting up and down the Mediterranean with a red-haired Italian mistress."
"So it was your answer. You did answer. Stephen, I should never worry you about ancient history at a time like this, but you look so well, you eat so well, and Dr. Messenius is so pleased with his hellebore that I thought I might just mention it, to show that I was neither unfeeling nor altogether stupid."
"I never thought you were either, soul," said Stephen, "though I did know that your sense of chronology was little better than mine, and I cannot remember my age without I do a subtraction with pen and ink. The letter was indeed my answer, and a mighty difficult answer it was to write. For one thing, it had to be written quick, because we were under sailing orders, because I wanted you to have it as soon as possible, and because I had an overland messenger waiting. For another thing, I had been flaunting a red-haired lady up and down the Mediterranean, or at least down it, from Valletta to Gibraltar by way of the African coast, and it certainly looked as though she were my mistress. But, however, she was not. The fact of the matter is, but this must not go beyond the two of us, Diana, the fact of the matter is that she was concerned with naval intelligence. The French at that time had some very dangerous secret agents in Malta, and there was a nest of traitors in the city itself. At a given crisis it was thought necessary to remove her at once. The removal certainly preserved her life, but it damaged her reputation among those who were not connected with intelligence. Even Jack was deceived, which surprised me. I had thought he knew me better.
So was Ray. So were a great many other people. I heard it on all hands. Oh, it was so galling to be treated tactfully, and never a word from you. Theseus, Andromache, and Naiad all came in, all of them with letters or messages for Sophie, and not a word for me. I was furious.
I am sure you were. Yet the letter was written, and as I say, it was difficult to write, because there would have been criminal imprudence in speaking of any matters to do with intelligence in a letter that might fall into the wrong hands. And without doing so, I could hardly exculpate myself, for to my astonishment I found that my bare assertion carried no weight. People smiled and looked knowing. Perhaps it was because her hair was red. There are all sorts of lubricious ideas abroad about red-haired women. Though I may add that her husband, an officer as far removed from the Marie Complaisant as you can possibly imagine, was not deceived. He knew that red hair and chastity were completely compatible.
Stephen, you did say that she was not your mistress.
I did, and I will say it again on the Holy Cross, if you wish.
Oh, don't do that. But then why did you say you had come to be forgiven?
Because I had so mismanaged things that you thought I needed forgiveness. Because I caused you distress. Because I was too stupid to send a copy of my letter by Theseus. Because I was fool enough not to suspect that traitor Ray.
Oh, Stephen! I have used you barbarously, barbarously, she said.
And after a pause, but I will make it up to you if ever I can. I will make it up to you in any way you like. They both raised their heads at the sound of a carriage.
That will be Messenius, she said. I must let him in. Ulrika will never hear, and the Lapp is cutting wood.
Messenius it was. He was particularly well disposed towards Stephen as a grateful, responsive patient, and a perfect example of what hellebore could do. He pointed out its virtues again, and Stephen said,
"Certainly, I shall prescribe it myself. Tell me, dear colleague, you would have no objection to my leaving your care in a day or so. There is a ship coming for me. Indeed, she may even be in Stockholm at this moment, and I should not like to keep her waiting."
"Objection? No," tapping Stephen's leg. "None, with my Basra dressing. So long as you can travel by coach and be conveyed directly to your cot, I will put up hellebore for your voyage. Is the ship coming from England?"
"No, from Riga."
"Then you may set your mind at rest. The wind turned fair today, but for a great while it was foul, and no ship could have got out of the Gulf of Riga except by venturing upon the Suhr Sound. I have a small pleasure boat, and I watch the weather most attentively."
"At least I shall have time to pack," said Diana. And then, in a very much happier tone, "Stephen, what am I to do while you are in South America?"
"Stay with Sophie while you look about for a place with good pasture for your Arabians, and a house in London town. I think I heard that the one in Half Moon Street was for sale."
"Shall you be long, do you suppose?"
"I hope not. But I tell you, my dear, that until the war is properly over and that Buonaparte put down, I must stay afloat, at least most of the time."
"Of course," said Diana,
who was of a service family.
"I believe I should best like to stay with Sophie until then, if she will have me. And perhaps I could use Jack's stables, they being empty. Stephen, did you mean we could buy a house in town? They are terribly expensive."
"So I understand. But my godfather, God rest his dear soul, left me a terrible lot of money. I forget what it comes to in English pounds, but the part that is already invested brings in far more than the pay of an admiral of the fleet. When peace comes, we can have a house in Paris, too."
"Oh, what joy! Stephen, could we really? I should love that. What a sad, mercenary creature I am. I find my heart is quite thumping with happiness. I was quite pleased to have my husband back, but to find him covered with gold from head to foot as well fairly throws me into transports. How vulgar!"
She sprang up from her seat, walked up and down the room with an elastic step, looked out of the window and said,
"There is Jagiello in his coach, and Lord," she cried, "he has Jack Aubrey beside him on the box."
Jack came into the room on tiptoe, with an anxious, apprehensive face, followed by Martin and Jagiello. He kissed Diana in an absent, cousinly way and took Stephen's hand in a warm, dry, gentle grasp.
"My poor old fellow," he said. "How do you do?"
"Very well, I thank you, Jack. How is the ship? And has she her Paul Davy?"
"She is in fine form. Brought us out of the Sewer Sound under t'gansels. Going like a racehorse, starboard tacks aboard, stunsails aloft and alow, nip and tuck in that damned narrow Vormsi channel. You could have tossed a biscuit onto the lee shore, and she has a dozen bolts of the kind of Paul Davy they serve out in heaven."
Stephen gave his creaking laugh of satisfaction and said,
"Diana, allow me to present my particular friend, the Reverend Mr. Martin, of whom you have heard so much. Mr. Martin, my wife."
Diana gave him her hand with a welcoming smile and said,
"I believe, sir, you are the only gentleman among our friends that has been bitten by a night ape."
They spoke at some length about the night ape, the capybara, the bearded marmoset. Ulrika and the Lap brought coffee, and in a pause Stephen said,
"Jack, are you alongside that elegant quay in the old town?"
"Yes, moored head and stern to bollards, and she has already turned round."
"Would it be convenient if we came aboard tonight?"
"I should like it of all things," said Jack. "I do not trust this breeze to hold for another 24 hours. "Can you indeed travel with a broken leg?" asked Jagiello.
"Messenius said I certainly might, if I went to the ship in a coach. Jagiello, would you be so kind?"
"Of course, of course. We will carry you downstairs on a door, taken off its hinges, and prop you up inside, with Mr. Martin to hold you. I shall drive at a very gentle trot, and you shall have a colonel's escort from my regiment."
"Diana, my dear, does that suit you at all, or would you sooner have another day or two to pack?" "Give me a couple of hours," said Diana, with shining eyes, "and I am your man. Gentlemen, do not stir, I beg, but finish your coffee. I will send Pishan up with some sandwiches."
Presently the gentlemen did stir, however, or at least Aubrey and Jagiello went off to see whether a door Jagiello remembered in his grandmother's barn would answer, and whether one of her remaining maids might not bear a hand in the packing.
"Surely I hear Bonden below," said Stephen, when he and Martin were alone. "Is Perdine here?"
"To tell you the truth," said Martin, "he is not. Unhappily we had a disagreement this morning, and Captain Pullings put him in irons. I do hate informing," he went on, "but without the least intention of catching him out, I came upon him siphoning laudanum from one of the carboys and replacing the tincture with brandy."
"Of course, of course, of course," murmured Stephen. "What a heavy simpleton I was never to have struck upon that."
And when Martin had finished his sad tale of Padine's violence on having his bottle taken away from him, he said,
"I was very much to blame for leaving such things in his reach. We shall have to take the whole matter seriously in hand. We cannot turn him into the world a mere opium-eater."
They mused for a while, and Martin gave Stephen an account, a very long and detailed account of their doings in Riga, and of the manners of the Letts and their Russian masters. He had gone on to speak of the presumably Sclavonian Grebes far out on the broad Dvina when Diana came in. She gave Stephen an extraordinarily violent shock, one that needed all his recovered strength and the leaves he was chewing to withstand, for she was wearing the green riding habit of his dream.
"Stephen," she said, her eyes brighter still, "I have packed all I need for the time, a couple of trunks, the rest can follow by sea. The coach will be round in 5 minutes with Countess Tessin's door, but I am not coming in it with you. You need a man to hold you, and with him and the door there is no room for me, so I am going to ride," laughing with pure joy. "I am going to fetch your things from the hotel and put flowers in our cabin."
"My dear," said Stephen, "do you know an apothecary's shop near the hotel, with monsters in the window and a stuffed armadillo?"
"And the apothecary very small?"
"That is the place. Pray step in. Have you someone to hold your horse? The Lap will go with me, and buy all the coca leaves he has left. It is only the tail of a sack."
"Stephen, you will have to give me some money."
And when he waved to his coat,
"You see, Mr. Martin, what horse leeches we wives do become?"
The surprise lay, as Jack had said, moored head and stern against the quay. Her deck had a somewhat deserted look, for Tom Pullings and the purser were below trying to disentangle the Rieger merchant's accounts, and a fair number of men were on shore leave until 6. West was the only officer on the quarterdeck, and it so happened that the party of hands making dolphins and paunch mats on the forecastle were all Shelmerstonians. West was gaping rather vacantly over the taffrail when he saw an extraordinarily handsome woman ride along the quay, followed by a groom. She dismounted at the height of the ship, gave the groom her reins, and darted straight across the brow and so below.
"Hey there!" he cried, hurrying after her. "This is Dr. Maturin's cabin. Who are you, ma'am?"
"I am his wife, sir," she said, "and I beg you will desire the carpenter to sling a cot for me here," she pointed.
And then, bending and peering out of the scuttle, she cried,
"Here they are! Pray let people stand by to help him aboard. He will be lying on a door."
She urged West out of the cabin and on deck, and there he and the amazed foremast hands saw a blue and gold coach and four, escorted by a troop of cavalry in mauve coats with silver facings, driving slowly along the quay with their captain and a Swedish officer on the box, their surgeon and his mate leaning out of the windows, and all of them now joined by the lady on deck, singing "A tutti contenti saremo così, a tutti contenti saremo, saremo così," with surprisingly melodious, full-throated happiness. This concludes the reading of The Letter of Mark by Patrick O'Brien, copyright 1988 by Patrick O'Brien. This book was read by Simon Vance.